So yes, there is an end to what you are expected to clinically contribute to the growth of your practice. At this point, if you intend to accommodate your team's bonus drive, you're going to have to add additional treatment capacity to the practice in the form of a second practitioner. I might mention that some doctors hesitate at this point, and many of them go into a decade-long rumination about the appropriateness of their adding a doctor to the practice. Because they don't want to, they will literally fool themselves for years into continuing the quest for non-associate growth. This process drags on as they blame their staff, their location, lack of successful marketing strategy, any number of things for the plateau that they stay on, when in fact it's really the need for an associate doctor. I found that typically the doctor falsely believes that he or she has an untapped reserve of clinical treatment capacity, always thinking that if staff would just get committed to this growth project, everything would really take off. I found that one of the main reasons that doctors tend to go into this state of denial about their need for an associate is that they fear they won't have the same net profit from the associate production that they've had in the past, or worse, there won't be a profit at all. I'd like to address this point. First of all, yes, you could end up in the red by adding an associate. If you go back a few months to the Whitehall recordings, you'll recall that we released one about the timing and profitable application of an associate doctor. I've had doctors who fail to make a profit without adding an associate, so I know it's not only possible to go broke with an associate, it almost certainly increases the odds of doing so. But if the practice is truly staff-driven and highly consumerized, you can successfully and profitably add doctor number two. What you have to keep in mind is that you will not, under any circumstances, net the same income from doctor number two's production as you have from your own. If for no other reason, the fact that you have to pay this doctor a substantial percentage of his or her production in the form of personal compensation, not to mention the fact that they have a tendency to come up with a small case average. The doctor who hopes to successfully and profitably bring on doctor number two needs to keep in mind that above all else, the associate production not only carries a lower expectation of income or net, it's actually a different classification of income. This is unearned income. Oh, I know, you manage the staff, etc. But keep in mind that if you wait to bring on number two until you've achieved the production requirements I mentioned earlier on this recording, whatever the associate doctor nets for you is above and beyond the profits you would have ever enjoyed anyway. That's right, it's gravy. To implement number two prior to owner maximization is to experience what we at Whitehall refer to as displacement. That's the exchange of an owner production dollar for that of an associate production dollar. You don't want this. To avoid displacement, you need to follow the rules we've just given you. Don't bring on number two until you've hit the production guidelines of maximization already mentioned. This brings up another point that I've wanted to cover for some time. At our earlier Whitehall financial seminars, many years ago, we used to show a five stages of practice graphic. It showed an upward line representing the growth stage of practice, followed by a flat line we called the profit plateau. When doctors hit the plateau, they were warned to make necessary adjustments to their lifestyle to allow them to save their age. I think you all know about saving your age. If you're 40, you save $40,000. What I've noticed since the early days of Whitehall is that many of the doctors ultimately ended up stuck not on the plateau, but on a false plateau. That is, they think they've mistakenly maxed out. The production guidelines I've just laid out on this recording should put doctors on notice that many of them, many of you, have hit false plateaus. Breaking out of that plateau is really the topic of another discussion. As to the question of when and where does it all end, well, make sure you don't mistake where the finish line actually is. And remember, when the time comes and the conditions are right, the profitable growth line can be extended upward once more, albeit at a gentler angle of ascent, with associate production. All right, next question. A doctor writes, Greg, in the past, I know you advocated doctors being completely out of debt. On some of your more recent recordings, it seems that you're not against doctors borrowing to expand their practices. So which is it, out of debt, or are there circumstances where debt makes sense? Great question. First of all, this doctor gets high marks for noticing the discrepancy. But yes, I did say that we should all be completely out of debt and that there are circumstances where borrowing to expand is actually called for. When a doctor first opens his or her practice, they usually have to go deeply into debt. I haven't heard many people argue that startup debt is really unavoidable. Think about the circumstances surrounding startup debt. We have a doctor who's not only taking on massive startup debt, but he or she is also dragging several $100,000 of school loans in their wake. This doctor's challenge isn't limited to this massive debt. He or she also has a monthly overhead associated with the new practice, not to mention the fact that they haven't got patient one. If you think about it, it almost sounds like the old Houdini trick, you know, where they would shackle hands and feet, have himself wrapped in chains, sealed in a locked vault, and placed underwater. No doubt the startup doctor and his or her accompanying debt load. On the other hand, the established practitioner who's mastered the art of patient management, certainly to the point where he or she has so many new patients that a financed expansion is in order, well, that's a completely different story. If you look back on your own personal investment history, there's probably never been an investment that gave you a better rate of return than your own practice startup. You invested several $100,000 in the startup process and then went on to enjoy an ongoing yield of several $100,000 per year ever since. Most people didn't do that well even at the height of the tech stock run-up. A few lucky doctors, however, managed to get a second and occasionally a third chance to experience startup investment rates of return. As to whether this should be done with borrowed money is a separate discussion. One of the time-honored rationale for borrowing is that you shouldn't tie up your personal investment money since you can do so much better investing in the market. That is, tie up your own money in an expansion. You should borrow for an expansion and take all your personal investment money and go out and do something risky with it, or so the story goes. Since most of my clients invest in municipal bonds, there's not much argument for that approach. The return on investment dynamics for expansion are really hard to refute. Even when the expansion involves investing $1.5 million in land, buildings, and equipment, if the potential increase in monthly profits is great enough, this is a wise move, even if borrowing is required. I've seen doctors take on over $1 million of additional debt to expand and increase their monthly overhead by $12,000 in the process. Some of them then turned around and increased their monthly incomes by $50,000 a month. You see, again, the return on investment here is hard to refute. $12,000 a month in extra overhead gets $50,000 a month of additional income. $1 million invested, even if borrowed, adds $600,000 to this person's disposable income. Yes, there are cases where doctors finance an expansion only to head quickly into bankruptcy. So why do some win with the borrowing while others accelerate their own demise? Let's take a look at a few of the rules for financed expansion. First, you need demand. Some of you have heard us talk about the two great practice management challenges, demand and delivery. If your rationale for expansion isn't existing excess demand, then you're expanding for the wrong reasons, and if you're borrowing, I really think you're going the wrong direction. I've heard doctors talk about how an attractive new clinic building along a busy road will work like a new patient magnet. In other words, they're seeing the building as a demand solution instead of a delivery solution. Some doctors have told me that they want to use debt to get their name on as much appreciating real estate as possible. I personally can't support this approach unless it involves getting just enough clinic space to meet the demand needs of the clinic. As to the argument of which is better, owning or renting a clinic, I would repeat my old adage. There is statistically no difference between buying and leasing clinic space over time unless the resale value of the purchased space is dramatically increased over the holding period. To do this, you either have to buy extremely low or sell extremely high. Doing one or both of these predictably is proven to be a challenge for the greatest investment minds of our time. There are three main borrowing scenarios that are supported at Whitehall. First, if you're borrowing to purchase a home. Second, starting a practice. Third is to borrow for the expansion of an over-demanded or soon-to-be-over-demanded practice. So yes, there are three good reasons to go into debt. There is, however, no good reason to stay in debt. If you've been to one of our financial seminars, you already know that we recommend that you work to be completely out of debt in 10 years or less. We call the plan for becoming debt-free the Master Plan. Within the Whitehall Master Plan, there are five classes of debt and expense. They're all calibrated to be completely paid off within a 10-year window. If a doctor ends up needing to borrow for an expansion, we only suggest that they time the repayment to coincide with their original 10-year Master Plan payoff date. If 5 years into their 10-year master plan, they need to borrow $200,000 for an expansion, we only ask that they use a 5-year amortization to hit their original master plan debt elimination target. So to answer your question, yes, there are times when Whitehall does sanction our clients to borrow money, but no, there's no good reason to stay in debt. I feel like the person who does so is in the process of dangerously overestimating his or her ability to earn or invest. When we talk about debt being called for during a demand-driven expansion, you'd also have to keep in mind the other debt the doctor may be carrying. In other words, he may also have substantial personal debt to cloud this picture of debt-based expansion. I found a lender's website recently that talked about personal debt statistics. It said, when applying for a loan, you'll be charged a higher rate of interest if you have a debt-to-income ratio greater than 45%. If this is the case, you're going to be considered by the lender as overextended. This debt ratio is determined by dividing your total personal income into your consumer debt balance. Consumer debt would be considered your non-practice debt less your mortgage, mainly credit cards, recreational vehicle loans, etc. Before clearing a doctor to borrow for a demand-driven expansion, I'd want to know that his personal debt ratio were well within this safe zone. All right, let's go on to our next question. A doctor writes, Greg, I have an employee who for years has been a great worker. She's excellent with patients. But as of late, her work has gone downhill, and even after talking with her about it, there's been no improvement. It almost seems like she wants to get fired. Doctor, this is not as unusual or as mysterious as it may seem. I was reading that a popular method of suicide is to knowingly wave a gun in front of a policeman. There are actually statistics kept on this very type of suicide. It's called death by policeman. There are people who want to die, but for whatever reason aren't comfortable with the idea of being directly responsible for their own death. I think many employees grow bored with the job, but they feel like they can't take the risk of quitting only to find out they can't get a better job and then have regret. It has a lot to do with guilt. They fear the guilt that will follow if they willingly quit and then end up worse off. There are actually staff who want to be fired, so they're left then with no choice but to go look for another job. You know, let's face it. After 15 years, the only thing that changes in the office is the faces of the patients. Yes, staff can eventually lose interest in the practice and in their job. If you spot this death by suicide syndrome, you need to step in. Check and make sure you've given the appropriate number of fair warnings, documented the problems, warnings, etc., and then you have to act. I realize that this is especially difficult with someone who's been a faithful employee for many years, but for the sake of the entire team and the practice, it has to be done. All right, we've talked about statistics, bonus maintenance, practice finance, and employee evaluation. I hope you like this format. We're going to be using it from time to time to enable us to answer more of our doctor's questions in the time allotted on our monthly recordings.